from 90.1 WFYI Public Radio. Welcome to the Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you.
Hello and welcome to The Art of the Matter. I'm Sharon Gamble. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Buscelli Wallerap Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owl Studios at owlstudios.com.
And I'm Travis DiNicola. Today I'll get a preview of Daphnis at Chloe, being presented by the ISO and Dance Kaleidoscope.
I'll take a look at a new biography on the artist William Forsythe.
And I'll find out about the upcoming Independent Music and Art Festival at the Harrison Center. Plus, there'll be that arts calendar we call...
What'll we do? All that and more right after the latest news from NPR. The Indianapolis Symphony Orchestra, Dance Kaleidoscope, and Clues Memorial Hall are partnering to present the fully staged version of Maurice Ravel's Daphnis at Chloe in June. This ambitious collaboration will be conducted by ISO music director Christoph Urbanski and will feature original choreography by DK artistic director David Hochoy. It will also feature the full Indianapolis Symphonic Choir. Travis DiNicola spoke with the ISO's CEO, Gary Gintzling, and Jan Virgin, executive director of Dance Kaleidoscope, to find out more about this partnership.
Jan, Gary, welcome to Art of the Matter. Great to have you both in the studio today.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for having us.
Absolutely. So this is a pretty exciting collaboration on a piece that I understand is not normally done in its entirety with dance and with the music. Before we sort of talk about the piece itself, let's talk a bit about this collaboration between the ISO and Dance Kaleidoscope, because I know it's not the first time you've worked together.
No, I think there's a long history, and Jan's been around longer than I have around town, so yeah. So she could probably talk. But I think this is sort of the third big collaboration that the ISO and DK and Clues as well have been involved in.
Yes. Go up. It is. The first one we did was The Planets, and it was phenomenal, and we had six organizations involved. And the second one was Scheherazade, mm-hmm. and then this one. And so we have a great history of working with the ISO, and so you either collaborate where we all take a chance, mm-hmm. and we all pitch in, and we do whatever it is to put the piece on. And Clues Hall, Memorial Hall, has joined us, and this will be the third time they're involved in this. And it is a true collaboration. Dance Kaleidoscope's taking the same chance that the ISO is, and so is Clues. And other times, the ISO hires Dance Kaleidoscope. We work together, mm-hmm. but it's not in it's we're collaborating to bring a piece, but we are assured of a fee. Mm-hmm. And this collaboration, we are all in it together to make it happen.
All taking a bit of a risk here.
Absolutely.
This must have taken quite a lot of planning. I know that both of you plan your schedules, your seasons, quite far in advance. Mm-hmm. So how long have you been conceiving of this?
Certainly for more than a year now, I would say. And I think I think the important element of the collaboration is really, I think it's a great way to show the community sort of the rich diversity and range of arts organizations that we have here. And I think it's fair to say that none of our organizations would have mounted a project like this on our own.
Mm-hmm.
But when a project like this presents itself to us and our music director, Christoph Urbanski, was motivated to have an opportunity to do the complete Daphnis project and to work with David and Dance Kaleidoscope, and so you put all those pieces in place, and it's a real chance to sort of bring something to the community that otherwise just would never be possible here.
Gary, tell me a bit more about the music and what Ravel's vision was here for Daphnis and Chloe.
Well, it's certainly, I think, arguably Ravel's masterpiece, and you rarely get to hear the full score. The second suite is performed often in concert by orchestras, sometimes with chorus, sometimes without chorus. We should say there's a full chorus, and the Indianapolis Symphonic Choir will be joining us as well. But the full piece with chorus and choreographed is something that's rarely mounted. It's complicated, mm-hmm. and it's just a huge production. So it is a. I think it's a piece that really puts Ravel's amazing orchestration and use of color in the orchestra at the forefront, and you really get to experience sort of the lush symphonic landscape that he creates, like no other piece I know that Ravel's written.
Does the orchestra approach a piece like this differently when they know it's going to be performed with live dancers? I mean, this alone is quite unusual. I mean, frequently with a lot of dancing, more than the music's recorded. I mean, it's not often you get a chance to actually have a live symphony, you know, performed together with the dancers. So, does that change how the music is approached?
It'll certainly change. Christoph and Dave will be working together, I think, to collaborate on how they approach it musically. I think from the members of the orchestra standpoint, it's an incredibly difficult piece, just with a lot of notes, and so I think they're going to be spending a lot of their time preparing and learning the notes of this piece that I'm sure a few of them have ever played the complete score. I'm sure many of them have played the second suite, as I mentioned, and I think it's been at least 15 years since we've done it, the full score. And so you'll certainly, when an orchestra is playing with live dancers, the approach is different than if you have a little more flexibility, if you're doing something on your own without sort of having the responsibility of a group of people who are moving to the music. It's going to be a very different experience.
Now we're a few weeks out from when it's actually going to be performed. And so I'm guessing at this point, Dance Kaleidoscope and the symphony and then also the choir have been working separately on their different pieces. At what point do you all sort of pull it together? How much time do you have to do that, Jan?
Well, when we're working together, it's 2 to 3 nights ahead of the show.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like Gary said, we work separately, and while they are, while the symphony is working with the beat, the timing, the rhythm, we are also trying to do the same thing, but we might not have the same beat, the same rhythm. And so if the symphony speeds up, because that's the way they've been rehearsing it, but we don't, we have
right.
to speed up with them.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's the challenge that the audience probably isn't going to be aware of. And the dancers love it. There is a true challenge in either slowing down, speeding up. And I'm sure it's the same way with the members of the symphony.
Well, it really, I mean, certainly forces them to listen to the music carefully. But
that's right.
You know, I guess kind of the same question I asked Gary in reverse. I mean, do the dancers respond differently? Are they more,
yes.
Somehow, you know, inspired to, when the music is live, to take their dance to a new level?
Oh, absolutely. Everything you said and more. When we did the last collaboration with live music, one of our dancers made this comment. She went out and the orchestra started and she stopped. She got so overwhelmed that she said she just kind of stopped and had to, oh my gosh, they're playing for us to dance. And so, yes, definitely they respond. And the audiences respond too, because they're now getting the visual, the audio, and they are getting more than they usually get. You know, you've got your live music, you've got your chorus, and then you've got your dancers, and in this big hall.
Yeah.
So they're just getting more, and so everybody's feeding off of everybody.
Tell me a bit about the dance. I know that David Hochoy is choreographing this. He's working with the dancers right now. I mean, there's a little bit of a story, you know, sort of a love story of based in Greek mythology of, you know, two young lovers come together and trying to overcome these obstacles and then kind of celebrating all that. But I mean, a lot of the choreography, it's a little bit more of an abstracted piece, right?
Absolutely. David will take the story and it'll be his story. We can say boy meets girl, they fall in love, and then there are people, there are objects in their way, but David's going to interpret his own way.
Sure.
And the great thing about this piece in his choreography that I just recently learned is because the finale is huge, David started with that. So that he said he wanted to be energetic, new, and raring to go. And he wanted the dancers to feel the same way. So what he did is he started with the finale. And now, and then he went back to the beginning and is working toward the finale. And I thought that was really interesting. I didn't know he did that, but he said he often does that.
That's really cool.
Yeah. So.
And Travis, you had asked about how it all comes together.
Mm-hmm.
Christoph and David have met and have spoken a number of times about this, but it won't be until we all get in the same room and really see it that we'll have a chance. You know, of course, we on the musical side, Ravel wrote this some time ago. You know, back in between 1909 and 1912. But in essence, it'll be a world premiere of David's vision of what's happening on stage, and so you have this incredible score coming to life. From the orchestra pit while something brand new happening on stage. So that, I think, is really what makes it exciting. And by the way, we still have different programs that we're preparing, each weekend before we all get in the same room. So our
right.
musicians
it's not
may,
like you guys just stop working on everything else.
Exactly. So our musicians may be working on it individually at home. And of mm-hmm. course, Christoph has been studying it for some time. But, I think the audience may not realize and may appreciate that it all really comes together amazingly quickly in the context of as Jan said, just a few weeks before the performances, a few nights before mm-hmm. the performances, where we'll all get together and run through it a few times and work on spots, and before you know it, we're mounting this this amazing production with so many people involved. So it's really exciting, I think, for all of our organizations.
Well, it entails an enormous amount of trust in each organization's professionalism and abilities and preparedness for it, of course, as well, so that you can go right into your rehearsal and be just ready to go and work those things out. But that's got to be very exciting. Yeah.
It's a true compliment.
And a little nerve-wracking, too.
Yeah, exactly. But it's a compliment that for both of us that the quality of artistry is respected by all participants, or we mm-hmm. wouldn't be doing it. And so that says something, too, that this city is doing something that is bigger than we usually do, mm-hmm. more than we usually do, in Indianapolis. And when we collaborated to do the Planets, I remember a person came up to me and said, I forgot I was in Indianapolis. I sat here and literally it took me, I didn't know where I was. And that's a wonderful compliment that the diversity and the quality of the arts can come together and move people out of where they have been thinking or working or doing.
Absolutely. And Gary, for you, I mean, this is your wrapping up your second season here, right? Is that?
That's correct.
And I mean, this is a great partnership to be a part of. But I'm going to sort of put you on the spot here. I mean, you're looking at end of two seasons here of being the CEO of the Symphony, and it seems to be going very well. So congratulations on that. But are you what is your take about, I mean, sort of the artistic and cultural life of Indianapolis here?
Thanks. I think Jan said it great, which is that I think the power of this collaboration is that we have these amazing organizations here in town, mm-hmm. And we're all doing our own thing and focusing on our own missions as we should be. But there are these opportunities for us to come together and bring something like this to the community. And I think it really sort of transcends the ISO or Dance Kaleidoscope, and it becomes really a story about what's possible here in Indianapolis. And to bring a piece like this to life with David's vision of what's happening on stage, mm-hmm. with Christoph's musical leadership is really, to me, I think what makes these kinds of collaborations so exciting. And they're complicated enough that they can't happen very often. So mm-hmm. so we're not going to do this kind of thing every week. And that's why we really are all putting our efforts into making it. It's a special opportunity, and we want it to be as successful as possible. And that, I think, says a lot about our arts community here in town.
That's excellent. Let me ask you both while I have you here, if I may, separately, what's next, Jan? Because I know that you're already planning for next season for Dance Kaleidoscope.
Absolutely, we are. We've got quite a few things coming up. Our final show was just over, mm-hmm. Girl at the Piano. And then,
which was also a collaboration with the IMA.
That's exactly right. Mm-hmm. And we do try to collaborate mm-hmm. a lot. And it just opens Dance Kaleidoscope to new audiences, and it opens our regular audiences to new spaces, new groups. And then I would imagine we share a lot of the same people because mm-hmm. of the collaborations we've had over the years. And that's a positive. That's a wonderful positive. And then our season, it closes June 30th. And, of course, Dance Kaleidoscope's small, and we're struggling. We're working toward In the Black hard. And then the season You take a deep breath for about a week, and then you move
on. Get going right again.
That's right. And we move on. The dancers come back, and they will be working for Fringe, and they will be working to perform at the Tarkington, and then our season. And we will open with Carmina Burana, and that is Nikki's.
Oh, very good. But you mentioned Fringe, so you guys have a Fringe show again this year.
Yes. And this
that's so exciting. I love seeing Dance Kaleidoscope in that sort of very small, intimate venue that's part of Fringe.
This is different. This is going to be the dancers choreographing.
Oh, cool.
So it's almost David saying, okay, this is what's next, guys.
Neat.
Come see it.
That'll be very exciting. Yeah. That's great.
That's right.
Gary, you've got a few things going on this summer, something out at the Prairie.
We turn right around, actually, after our weekend at Clues and head right out to Symphony on the Prairie, which starts on June 20th. And we're also excited. I think this summer we've just recently announced a new project. We'll be having a series of lunchtime
concerts
downtown at the theater. And it's going to be $5 general admission for people to get in. We're going to let people bring their lunch into the theater, and that's going to start on June 19th. So just a chance to experience the ISO, get away from your desk for an hour and hear a short 30 to 45 minute concert. We pick some great music and give people no excuse to not hear the ISO.
And when
summer.
Do those start again? Because I just saw the notice about that series.
June 19th
great.
Will be the first one, Thursday the 19th, and then four consecutive Thursday afternoons. The doors open at 11:30, and the concert will start about 12:15.
And am I correct that that was also made possible with a grant from the estate of Margo Lacey Eccles?
That was, as well as the Ephraimson Family Fund also helped fund that new project for this summer.
That's awesome. I'm really glad you guys are doing that this summer.
Great.
Nice to have the symphony both in your downtown home as well as out at the Prairie as well.
We'll be doing a lot of back and forth this summer.
So. Well, I want to thank you both for coming into Art of the Matter Day. I really appreciate it. And best of luck with both your individual organizations and, of course, with this great collaboration with Daphnis and Chloe.
Thank you.
Thank you,
much.
Travis.
Thank you.
Travis DiNicola with the ISO CEO, Gary Gintzling, and Jan Virgin, Executive Director of DK. Daphnis and Chloe can be seen on Friday, June 13th, and Saturday, June 14th, at Clues Memorial Hall. You can get more information at dancecal.org, that's DANCEKAL.org, or IndianapolisSymphony.org. You're listening to The Art of the Matter on WFYI 90.1 FM Public Radio.
At the turn of the last century, Americans didn't yet have an artistic identity. Painter William Forsythe was one of the several high-profile Hoosiers who set out to change that. William J. Forsythe, the life and work of an Indiana artist, is a richly illustrated new biography by Rachel Berenson Perry. Sharon Gamble asked Rachel how Forsythe helped shape our modern identity and why she was attracted to this cantankerous fellow.
What drew you to this particular artist?
Well, I'm glad you asked that because Forsythe has always fascinated me because of his personality and the fact that his artwork seems a lot more spontaneous and, it's just different from the other members of the Hoosier Group who were the early Indiana artists who became the Hoosier Group in 1894 when they had an exhibit in Chicago and were recognized as very prominent Midwestern artists. Most of them had studied in Munich and then come back to Indiana to paint what they knew best. And so they were really groundbreaking at that time. They had to create their own market for landscapes. And Forsythe was a big component of that. But he also spent many, many years teaching. So he influenced a lot of the next generation of Indiana artists. And he had a very cantankerous personality. And so I found that I wanted to research him because I was interested in his personality. He was really a jerk. But one reason why he became endearing to me when I was reading his letters was because he was very aware of the fact that he was a jerk. So I have this quote that I can read that's relevant to that.
Please.
That says something to that. And this is part in the book. To one whose watchword is progress, it is a humiliating fact to find himself making a series of miserable, contemptible failures, one after another, and he realizes the depths and wonders how he could ever have been the conceited jackass he once was, and supposing that he could create anything. Then, in the midst of his dejection and humiliation, he suddenly finds his fellow students hovering around his easel and murmuring words of praise, approbation, and finally wakes up to the fact that he has made something better than he's ever done before and becomes conceited and arrogant and hopeful as he ever was. So he had very strong opinions about art, and was never shy about expressing them. And then later, when he came back to the United States, he did seem to be rather arrogant. He didn't ever kowtow to the powers that be. He wasn't diplomatic. He picked fights with other artists. He especially disliked or seemed to be very jealous of T.C. Steele and picked fights with him all the time. And so a lot of people, he was pugnacious. He really, a lot of people, I think, probably disliked him. But then when he got married to one of his students, Alice Atkinson, she kind of mellowed him out a lot, and she would kind of go around and clean up after his indiscretions. And I think he also, the fact that he was so loyal to his family and really, really adored his three daughters and was very loyal to his wife, endear him. Those things also endeared him to me.
Yeah, if anybody needed a softening influence, having three daughters as well as a wife would, you would think, might do it.
Right.
I also get the impression he was a little bit of a procrastinator. Like yes. He loved to paint in the fall, and he loved to go various places like Brookville or Cedar Farm.
Right.
And it's like every fall it was a little harder for him to come back.
Right. That was he very much was a procrastinator, and also seemed to forget to do things. He had his family. He was very tight with his brothers and sisters, and they were always helping him or reminding him that he needed to do certain things. And certainly when he was the president of the Society of Western Artists later in life, he actually might have been one of the causes of the demise of the organization, because he failed to do some of the things that needed to be done, the bureaucratic things that needed to be done. But the thing about his doing his plein air or outside painting in the summers and in the fall, it was something that he enjoyed so much. And going back to Indianapolis in the winter to be a teacher represented going back to the grindstone and going
and
back
bureaucracy
regular
too, right?
The bureaucracy, the regular hours, yeah. And also because he did have, or he thought that he had so many enemies in the city, he also felt, I guess, threatened to a certain extent as well.
So it's only a little over a century ago we're talking about, and it seems strange to us now, but can you give us a little more context about why artists around the turn of the last century felt like they had to go away to study, and why it was really kind of a radical move to paint scenes from here in our state?
Right. At that time, in the late 1800s, the people who had means, really the status symbol was to buy traditional European artwork, and there really weren't any art schools around Indiana around the 1880s. It was very difficult to get instruction, so unless you kind of apprenticed with a particular artist, you didn't have any opportunity to get instruction. Really, the only schools were in Europe, but it was also felt that you had to do that. You had to go to Europe to become a real artist. And then when they came back, a lot of people became expatriates. Like Frank Duveneck, who was in Ohio, kept going back to Europe. A lot of artists went back to Europe or went to the East Coast, where there was more of an art market. But to come back to Indiana, to the Midwest, where there really wasn't much of an art market, was considered to be very brave. They weren't. They did still submit their paintings to Eastern exhibits in Pennsylvania and New York, and actually got into the exhibits, but their names weren't known, so it was very difficult for them to get any traction for selling artwork. So the only things really that you could do when you came back, when they came back, and make a living were painting portraits, commissioned portraits, or teaching. And by the time William Forsythe came back to the United States, for Steele had already been back for a couple of years. And when T.C. Steele returned, he had to paint portraits for all of the patrons who had given him money to study in Europe. And he was on the north side of Indianapolis, while he was really at 16th and Pennsylvania.
Which was the north side.
Exactly,
yeah.
Which was the north side. And so his neighbors were wealthy people, and he quickly established a market. He was painting all the most important people in Indianapolis, and it was considered to be a status symbol to have your portrait painted by T.C. Steele. So by the time Forsythe came back to Indiana, the market was kind of sewn up. And really, the truth is that Forsythe didn't really have the kind of diplomatic personality that would have been required to paint portraits anyway. But he always resented the fact that when he came back, he didn't have an opportunity to paint, to try to make a living from painting portraits. Forsythe also was from a real blue-collar family. He lived on the South Side, and the whole family depended on these contracted jobs. They were house painters. So he really culturally was from a very different background than T.C. Steele, who T.C. Steele's grandparents had the first brick house in Owen County and pianos and libraries, and they were a very educated and cultured family compared to Forsythe, who was much more hardscrabble, blue-collar. And it's interesting to realize that those class distinctions, if you will, existed back then as they do today.
And might have even have been harder to transcend back then.
Right.
Because there's no, you know, social media evening things out for everybody.
Right. And you wouldn't be hanging around he wouldn't have been hanging around the same circles as T.C. Steele from the very beginning, even if they hadn't been artists. But Forsythe had the passion. He was extremely passionate about living his life as an artist. And he became a really sought-after teacher because he was able to translate that passion to other people. But he didn't have any patience at all for people who were dilettantes or who he considered to be people who really weren't taking art seriously. If you did take art seriously, he became a loyal friend for life. He would continue corresponding. He'd help you find a job and, you know, help you network in that way.
But again, that probably put him in a bad position because a lot of the people when he was teaching who might have been candidates to be students were well-bred daughters of well-to-do people
he didn't teach those people.
No,
of course, when he
first, it was harder, I'm sure.
Right. When he first came back, he did open a school with J. Otis Adams and Muncie, and they definitely had, I think they were all women in those classes, so they would have been wealthier women who were rounding out their cultural education by taking art classes.
Mm-hmm. So tell us about the role of the Society of Western Artists, and starting with explaining the name and why is the Society of Western Artists here in Indiana?
Right. The Society of Western Artists started in 1896, and at the time, we were the West. The Midwest was the West because they considered California to be the Far West. So really, the Midwest was referred to as the West. And it goes back to what I was saying before, where all the major exhibitions were on the East Coast. And so major artists, three major artists from each of the cities of St. Louis and Cleveland and Cincinnati and Indianapolis and Detroit got together and formed the society so that they could have an annual exhibition that would travel to all of the membership cities. And it was a force to be reckoned with and really did kind of freak out the East Coast organizers because they saw this major exhibition that was traveling all year to the different cities. And it was very efficient at gaining publicity, but unfortunately it didn't really translate into sales. So eventually around 1914, the society disbanded. And it was completely organized by artists, so you can imagine it was probably a nightmare.
Although, as you've pointed out in the book, Forsyth had maybe not equal skills, but certainly laudable skills as a writer,
yes,
as well
did.
As a
yes,
visual artist, which, and those things usually do not occur in the same brain.
Well, it's interesting that you say that. I do think that Forsyth was certainly much more prolific, and he was much clearer. His thoughts were much more clear than T.C. Steele's. I can still read essays that Steele wrote that I don't really understand mm-hmm. what he's trying to say.
Mm-hmm.
But Forsyth was more, I would say, publicly oriented. He was able to write about art in a way that was easily understood by the general public, sort of like me. I don't consider myself to be an art historian, but I think I can write about art history in a way that's readable for people who may not be that interested in art.
Very accessible.
Very accessible,
yeah.
Right.
Hey, speaking of access, so people who read this are going to be excited to know about an exhibit you're working on organizing this fall.
Right. That's going to be at the Indiana State Museum. It opens November 8th, and then it'll be there until March 29th of 2015. And it's called William Forsyth, Only the Strong Persist. Because that's a direct quote from Forsyth, who felt that to be an artist, you had to be extremely tenacious.
Sharon Gamble with Rachel Berenson Perry, author and retired fine arts curator of the Indiana State Museum. William J. Forsyth, The Life and Work of an Indiana Artist, is published by the Indiana University Press. You can learn more at their website or at Amazon.com or at any brick-and-mortar bookseller.
Hey, Travis.
Yes, Sharon.
You know what happens next week?
Well,
really soon.
We've got birthdays coming up, Sharon.
We have birthdays. It's our birthday month.
It is. I'm so excited.
Woo-hoo.
June is the Art of the Matter birthday month
it
for
really
Sharon
is.
And I. Yeah.
Ignore the fact that the show went on the air in September.
Whatever.
But the co-hosts have birthdays in June.
That's right.
One towards the beginning, one towards the end. Chocolate is always an appropriate gift, mm-hmm. as is a nice frosty microbrewed. No, we can't go there.
What? Anyway. Or just, you know, see us out at an arts event and say happy birthday.
And you know what? We have some of those arts events on our calendar we call
What'll
We Do for Our Birthdays.
For Our Birthdays. Actually, you know, so this is a really fun thing coming up. The Jazz Jam. These are a combination of workshops and jam sessions at the Jazz Kitchen. They're doing a bunch of them, actually. The first one is coming up on Saturday, May 31st, and then they're doing another one June 28th, July 26th, August 30th, and it's a combination of Indie Jazz Fest and the Jazz Foundation are doing these jazz jam workshops from noon to 2 p.m. on Saturdays at the Jazz Kitchen. And Kenny Phelps, who is just a fantastic drummer, is going to be on drums, and he's going to be working with musicians, not magicians, musicians, on everything from, you know, dealing with public performance and jazz combo etiquette and improv basics. You don't even need to register. You just show up with your saxophone or whatever instrument you play, and all instruments are welcome, and the workshops are free. I think this is a really cool thing. So sort of jazz jam sessions at the Jazz Kitchen. So show up there noon to 2. And maybe just show up if you want to hear some good music.
Yeah,
too.
Absolutely.
You never know, right?
Yeah, and he's going to be on the Art of the Matter here in a couple of weeks telling us some more fun things he has going on with Jazz Kitchen, Kenny Phelps, that is, and,
cool.
and also with Owl Studios.
Excellent.
So, yeah, indeed. Hey, Get Indievolved is
Indievolved.
It sounds kind of like there'll be some psychology and, you know, you'll be, you know, get in touch with your higher self. Well, in point of fact, you might. Mm-hmm. What it is kind of a meet and greet between people who want to volunteer for not-for-profits and not-for-profits who need volunteers. The folks who organize it are looking for 80 exhibitors and about 700 attendees, that is to say potential volunteers. The event is coming up on June 18th from 5:30 to 7:30 at the Stutz. There'll be meet, mingle, eat, drink, chance to talk to, if you're a potential volunteer, a chance to talk to some not-for-profits. And maybe you had on your list of resolutions this year to get involved with something new, to volunteer for something new, and this is your chance. If you want to learn out more, find out more, learn out more, just hop online and type Indievolved, V-O-L-V-E-D.
Okay, I think this may be one of the most clever golf type of outings for a nonprofit, because often, I mean, golf is fine, but often it doesn't really have a whole lot to do with the not-for-profit's mission.
Yeah.
And, you know, but a lot of not-for-profits use them as fundraisers. Well, the Heron College of Art and Design, Heron School of Art and Design, is
no.
doing a mini golf mega art event on June 7th from 6 to 9. And Pete and Alice Dye, Pete is the legendary
yes.
golf course designer. They're the co-chairs of the event. And what they have done is they have been working with Heron students. This is so cool. And a whole bunch of volunteers and Linda Freelander and co-chairs Kathy Springer-Brown and Joyce Summers are part of this group that they're basically going to transform Eskenazi Hall, which is where Heron's located, into a whole miniature golf course, all created by the students, the artists, multi-hole. And you can putt your way through all these one-of-a-kind holes. Heron alumni have helped create it, Heron students. I can't wait to see what they have come up with to create this miniature golf course.
And even if you're a terrible player, you want to get involved in this just to see it.
It just sounds like so fun, so much fun. Now, you
love
do have to get
it.
Tickets ahead of time. Tickets include a round of golf and food and drink. And you can go to the Heron website for the Heron School of Art and find out about the event for what they're calling the Heron Open, coming up on June 7th. But you do need to get your tickets now because it is going to sell out fast. And this
Absolutely.
Just looks like a ton
of
fun.
Oh, I hope that becomes a tradition, too. Mm-hmm.
You can even be a spectator, not to play, if you just wanted to come and watch.
You have to be really
cool.
quiet so as not to break people's concentration.
What a hoot.
I love it. Hey, a little while back on the Art of the Matter, you might have heard about a kind of a groundbreaking program that the Indianapolis Museum of Art is doing with the Indianapolis chapter of the Alzheimer's Association, using docent-led art experiences to help people with early-stage Alzheimer's and their families and caregivers and friends just have more fun in the world, have a new vocabulary to deal with some of what's going on in these folks' lives. And the next session of that is coming up June 3rd from 10 to noon. You do need to pre-register, so you need to call the Indianapolis Alzheimer's Association office to pre-register. But it can be extended family, it can be somebody's grandchildren or just their friends. And what an amazing experience, kind of changes the whole family through this great experience of art.
That sounds like a great program.
Yeah.
Sharon, we have to go, but before we do, just one quick reminder, the orangutans are open. You can go see them now. They're
it's
pretty
so
fantastic.
Cute. They're so cute. I had to convince Travis not to bring one home
the other day.
He really wanted to.
So we'll talk more about orangutans and art and everything else next week on the calendar we call
What Do We Do?
You're listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in Indianapolis and Central Indiana. Your hosts are Sharon Gamble and Travis DiNicola. If your arts organization has an event or activity of which you think we should be aware, please contact us at least 3 weeks in advance. You can write us at The Art of the Matter, care of WFYI, 1630 North Meridian Street, Indianapolis, Indiana, 46202. Or you can email us at artofthematter@wfyi.org. You can also hear The Art of the Matter on WFYI.org.
The Independent Music and Art Festival is an annual day-long free outdoor festival featuring local musicians, visual artists, and other independents at the Harrison Center at 16th and Delaware. Travis DiNicola spoke with Harrison director Joanna Taft and artist Chad Campbell about the festival.
Joanna, Chad, welcome to Art of the Matter. Great to have you guys here.
Thanks, Travis.
Good to be here.
Absolutely. Joanna, let's start with you. Let's talk a little bit about Harrison Center, which is continuing to be a real hub of artistic and cultural activity in downtown Indianapolis. Congratulations. I don't know how many years it's been. 15?
You know, it seems so long. I think 13.
13? Okay. Because I know that, what is this, like the 10th or 11th?
This is actually the 13th IMAF.
IMAF, okay.
But it kind of started as a festival before it was IMAF, so we count those first 2 years.
So tell me briefly about the Harrison Center. 16th and Delaware, pretty awesome space.
Well, we are a community arts center right at the corner of 16th and Delaware, and we are filled with 32 amazing artists, their studio space, and then four galleries and lots of activity. Yes. Many people come for First Fridays, mm-hmm. and they also come for music events, including our Singer-Songwriters Guild, which will be performing at IMAF this year.
Oh, excellent.
Yes.
Oh, very cool. Yeah, your First Fridays are always an event unto themselves. I mean, not just the gallery openings, but all the sort of ancillary activities you have that are going along with it. Very popular events.
And they're a lot of fun.
They are a lot of fun. And IMAF is part of this. Now, IMAF is not on First Friday. It's on the second Saturday in June. So that puts it June 14th, I believe.
That's right.
And goes from noon to 8 that day. And it features a great lineup of music as well as a lot of art going on. Tell me about the music.
This year, our bands are mostly from central Indiana, but we do have a band from Seattle, the Portland area. But what's really exciting to me this year is that last year we had a singer-songwriter come to us from Baltimore who spent 14 weeks writing a song a week about the neighborhood where the Harrison Center is located.
Oh,
and he's coming back. He actually lives in Chattanooga now. He's coming back, and he'll be performing some of these place-based songs that Indianapolis grew to knew and love.
That's really cool. And what's his name?
His name is Paul Smallman.
Okay. And so he'll be playing, it looks like, around 1:20 or so throughout the day. But performances, again, start at noon and go through 8 o'clock. A whole bunch of different bands all throughout the day. A lot of different styles of music, too.
That's right. We have everything covered, from hip-hop to folk to indie rock.
And it's free.
It's free. We think good music and good art should be accessible.
So in terms of the art, what is going on that day? I mean, among other things, Indiana Handicraft Exchange is coming back.
That's
right.
We'll have over 100 vendors inside and outside the building, actually in the back parking lot as well. We're expanding every year. And so we'll also have four food trucks. So there'll be art and food of every kind and lots of opportunities for people to connect and to connect to art and connect to people.
Lots of good stuff going on. And Chad is a part of it. Chad, so glad to have you on Art of the Matter today. I really just fell in love with your work a couple months ago when I was at Harrison Center First Friday. And if you would, I'll let you describe your work, if you will.
Well, I'm a found object artist. I prefer to work in mobile and stable work. You got one of my wall pieces.
Mm-hmm.
I'm pretty much telling little stories from my life in America, using the trash of American culture.
A lot of pieces from old electronic devices,
yes.
Radios, TVs, things like that. That's a big part of what makes up sort of the found objects in your work, right?
Yes, yes. I like tearing things down and using the objects inside that you don't normally see every day.
And something that also shows up a lot in your work are figures that
yes.
Are made out of wire. Tell me a bit about those, because they're really funky.
Oh, well, yeah, that it started with the copper. I like using the copper for human forms because it absorbs other metals. It kind of takes. It doesn't really give back. And it's constantly changing and transforming. So it is it kind of gives a human feel to it.
Mm-hmm.
The figures
Those come from wrestling. Wrestled for a long time. I've seen dudes in just about every position imaginable. So that kind of came naturally when starting to shape the men. But yeah, to show
really wrestling. That's cool because a lot of them to me almost look like, you know, like superheroes out of a comic book or something. Right. I mean, they're so animated and physical.
It's struggle. That's been a big part of my work is struggle. Struggling with American culture. Struggling with looking at the world and wrapping your mind around the world that is out there the way it has become.
Well, the one piece, and you mentioned it because I did, you know, in full disclosure, I bought one of your pieces, which I'm delighted about. And it is a wall piece. And sort of the back part of it is sort of some TV parts and radio and sort of an antenna part. And there's this great figure of a guy who's sort of like bursting out of it. Is he escaping from it? Is he, you know, trying to escape from it? You don't quite know. But it's really interesting because part of his head is made out of sort of like a glass fuse with another little guy inside of that, and he's trying to escape too, and there's a sense of wrestling as you say.
Yes, that one was kind of that moment when you're getting ready to just let go, just let it happen, whatever the situation may be, that letting your knowledge, letting what you've accumulated just take over and bring you through the obstacle in front of you.
So your work is going to be featured as part of the Independent Music and Art Festival, correct?
Yes, yes.
In a gallery? You'll have a gallery?
Yes, I will be in the City Gallery, actually.
Okay.
It will be the Meanwhile a Few Doors Down show, just kind of my view on the area, the King Park neighborhood. Inspired by the architecture, the feel of the people, the busyness, the weaving in and out, just the interaction of this area of town, pretty much. Using, once again, the trash that is formed from this type of an atmosphere.
And I'm gathering or guessing that some of the trash is actually from the neighborhood you're working with, right?
Much of it is, yes. Yeah. I've been here a while, yeah. I've accumulated quite a bit from the neighborhood.
So how's the work going on preparing for the show?
It's going. It's fun.
Yeah?
It's ongoing. There is that cutoff point where we can't go any further. You have to stop playing with it. But right now I'm still playing with it and having a good time with it. So.
Cool. How long have you been at the Harrison Center?
Oh, geez. 7 years, I believe. Yeah.
That's great. What does that mean to you? I mean, as an artist, to have that sort of longevity and that sort of shared community space?
This is really, it feels like home. This is the first place I've been that actually it feels like home, like my community, my neighborhood. It's pretty nice. It's you have all the artists right there. You don't have to seek people out. There's always someone to have a good conversation with, someone to keep you going. It's just home. That's what it is for me, my son, our puppy dog. It's home.
That's really
cool.
That's
what it is.
That's fantastic. You're smiling, Joanna.
You can see why I love my job.
Hey, Chad mentioned the City Gallery, which is one of the galleries that is in the Harrison. Tell me a bit about that one, because that's kind of a special gallery, a little bit different than some of the other galleries.
That's right. The City Gallery has a special mission. It shows place-based art, and that's art that celebrates place. And we love the way that artists are movement leaders, and they lead all of us. And the City Gallery allows them to lead this whole city to celebrate our city. And so, number one, it's a gallery. Number two, it's a resource cafe. Mm-hmm. We actually have a customer service person, kind of like a concierge for the city, that connects people to culture, community, and place. And so when people want to know how they can get involved with neighborhoods and neighborhood festivals and the traditions of a particular neighborhood or a neighborhood association or finding a place to call home, we can connect them to all those things.
The City Gallery has been open now, what, a little over 2 years?
Since 2011.
Okay. Wow, a little bit longer than I thought. And it's always just packed, I mean, during First Friday night. How does it operate throughout the rest of the time?
We're open 9 to 5, and it's a co-working space. So a lot of people come in and with their laptop and do their work. Other people come in to ask questions or get connected. Most of our connecting work happens during the week by telephone and email, although people are welcome to walk in. So we try to have a presence online and a presence in a storefront. So depending on how you're wired, you can connect with us easily.
So what is next for Harrison?
Well, we
that you
love
can share with us.
Well, we love what we're doing, and we think we've been developing some significant best practices in the area of placemaking, creative mm-hmm. placemaking. And so, in the next, we have a commitment to focus on the King Park neighborhood through December because of our Art Place grant. But when that grant runs out, we will be looking to expand the mission of the City Gallery and to partner with some other neighborhoods where we can share those best practices. And we hope that Excellent. Indianapolis will continue to revitalize, as we've seen happen in the other neighborhoods where we've worked.
Very, very good. Excellent. I do have to ask about First Friday. So, I mean, do you still have a First Friday in June since you've got the big festival coming up on the 14th? Or how does that work?
Well, Travis, I'm old. we decided several years ago it was kind of hard for us to put on this big festival
yeah.
and do First Friday the week before.
That's what I thought.
And so several years ago we got into the rhythm of using the First Friday in June to visit other First Fridays, mm-hmm.
which is a nice
pretty
thing to
awesome
do.
Because we never get to see the other galleries. So that's the day that we all go out and see the city, and then next Saturday we welcome everyone back to the Harrison
Excellent.
Center.
Very good to know. Great. Well, I hope you guys have a great time both enjoying First Friday on the 6th and then, of course, putting on the fantastic Independent Music and Art Festival on the 14th. And, Chad, I want to thank you especially for coming into Art That Matters. It's always great to talk with an artist I haven't had a chance to have on the show before about their work.
Oh, thank you for having me.
And best of luck with your work. And, Joanna, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Travis DiNicola with Harrison Center for the Arts, director Joanna Taft, and artist Chad Campbell. The Independent Music and Art Festival takes place on June 14th from noon to 8 p.m. More information is available at harrisoncenter.org, harrisoncenter.org. Thanks for joining us today. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Buselli Wallerab Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owl Studios at owlstudios.com.
Please listen to The Art of the Matter next week, Thursday at 8 p.m. and Saturday at 7 a.m., when I'll get a preview of two art exhibits that look back at the artists and galleries which first made Mass Avenue a destination back in the 1980s.
Oh, I can't wait to hear that. I'll find out about a new study on the impact of the arts in our community, and we'll have that arts calendar we call
What'll We Do? So please listen next weekend to The Art of the Matter here on 90.1 WFYI Public Radio.
You've been listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in Central Indiana and Indianapolis. Your hosts are Sharon Gamble and Travis DiNicola. Today's show was edited by Melissa Davis and produced by Travis DiNicola. The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you.